You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It is Friday, January 13th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar, filling in for Tom Hartman as he travels in Europe, finishing out your Friday. I'm on loan from the Majority Report, and what a crazy week. It seems like ages ago that we had the New Hampshire primary. It was just a couple of days ago. Am I right? It actually feels like it was months ago. And so much has happened in just this past week, not just in the race, but I think in a conversation that's opened up in this country over the past several months, I think in a large part a function of the Occupy Wall Street movement, but now seems to be championed by those Republicans who really want to prevent Mitt Romney from becoming the GOP's primary candidate, or a presidential candidate, I should say. And it remains to be seen if they're going to be effective. We're over a week and a half away, from the South Carolina primary. And I don't know if you folks have seen it, but Newt Gingrich, backed by $5 million from a gambling mogul, and sort of with the opportunity that's been opened up for him because of Citizens United, sunk I don't know how much money into a 30-minute film about Mitt Romney, ostensibly about Mitt Romney and his time at Bain Capital, which I think is one of the best critiques of the capitalism that has developed in this country over the past 30 years that I've seen maybe anywhere, certainly from any professional politicians. And I don't know if that was his agenda per se. I think Newt Gingrich simply is a very, very petty and prideful man who is very, very angry at Mitt Romney. And hopefully the country will in some way benefit from this. We'll dig into that into a minute. We're going to be talking to Robert Reich later in the this hour about his perspective on this. I think it is a tremendous turn of events, and one which is simply part of a snowball that's been rolling down the hill now for nearly, well, I guess 4 or 5 months. And I think in the end, regardless of what happens in South Carolina, regardless of the impact of the rhetoric coming from Newt Gingrich and guys like Rick Perry in the Republican Party, the real benefit is not going to be just to President Obama in the general election. But more importantly, I think there's an opportunity here for a real assessment as to capitalism as we now know it in this country. And do not kid yourself into believing that capitalism is simply one static thing. And it is going to force an examination as to what the economy, what a good economy is supposed to do. Is it supposed to simply enrich a small subset of Americans and the rest of us just hope that a couple of those crumbs will fall off the table? Or is a good economy supposed to be defined by how many people across the country, how many of its citizens it helps? This is a debate that is a long time coming, and so I welcome it. We'll also be talking on the program today about this. I don't even know how to characterize this. And if you ever wanted a wonderful opportunity to see what is wrong with the establishment media, the corporate media in this country, there was a, you know, it was just sort of almost what felt like one of those throwaway pieces by the New York Times ombudsman yesterday. And he literally asked the question. It's hard for me to actually, I mean, the piece is titled, "Should the Times Be a Truth Vigilante?" He's literally asking the readers of the New York Times, do you think that we really should be focused on reporting the truth. We'll dig into that. I mean, that if you want to call in and weigh in on that question, I don't know. Do you think the New York Times should be in the business of truth-telling? 866-987-8466 or 866-987-TOM. You can also give us a call at 866-745-2667. Meanwhile, the Marines, there's a horrible, just a horrible, disgusting video that has been released on YouTube of U.S. Marines urinating on the, I mean, this is just, it's horrific, urinating on the corpses of suspected Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. Apparently, the Marines have been identified. They will may be subject to a criminal investigation. I mean, it remains to be seen. And, you know, the broader lesson from something like this is not that when you train people to kill, you necessarily also need to train them that the people they're killing are less than human, that they deserve no real respect as human beings. The broader lesson goes beyond the fact that we have some type of breakdown in the training of our military personnel if they're urinating on the corpses of these people. The lesson is this is part of war. This is part of war, and we must, as a society, fully absorb what we are doing, not only to the people that we are killing, not only to the, in the case of Iraq, by our own country's admission, the hundreds, literally over 100,000 civilians that we killed, the 4 million refugees that we created, whether it's the drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan that are killing civilians. We also must account for what we are doing to our young men and women that we send into battle. The costs of war are massive in terms of the human toll on the victims of the innocent civilians, but also our own military. And so this is a good time for America. You know, these opportunities come around and people try and dismiss them as some type of, it's abhorrent behavior, but it's not an aberration. This is what war is, and it must be factored into the costs of war. What we do to our young men and women that we send over there or anywhere and train them to kill and perceive other people as less than people. And it's grotesque and it's sad, but make no mistake about it. This is what war brings about. This is not some type of fluke. So we will be talking about all of that today. We'll also be talking to Dahlia Lithwick on the Supreme Court, and we'll be talking to some Occupy people about their plans for next week. The next week for Occupy Wall Street and the Occupies around the country is going to be quite large. We've got Occupy Congress in D.C. We've got Occupy the Dream that is taking place in D.C. and around the country in front of Federal Reserve buildings. All that and more will be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Coming up, your phone calls. We are back. Sam Cedar on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm or majorityreportradio.com. Filling in for the great Tom Hartman. Always a pleasure and honor for me to fill in for Tom Hartman. I've been a longtime fan, sometime colleague back in the day, and so it's a real pleasure. Right now, we have just what I think is just an astonishing turn of events in the Republican primary, not so much in terms of what the outcome of the Republican primary is going to be, but we are seeing Republicans who really, really just, I think, on a visceral level, hate Mitt Romney. And I think on a visceral and really more of a personal level, I mean, let's face it, Mitt Romney's positions, at least now, are fundamentally no different from the far right in the Republican Party. But I think there's some real personal animosity. And when you've got a guy like Newt Gingrich, who I think feels, I have no political career anyways, if I can derail this guy's nomination, I'll do it. And he gets $5 million from a billionaire who seems to dole out $5 million with less thought than I give to what I'm going to buy for lunch today, and makes a 30-minute film about Mitt Romney, ostensibly about Mitt Romney and his time at Bain Capital, but it's really fundamentally a critique of capitalism. And you've got, you know, Rick Perry, for instance, going around saying, this is vulture capitalism. I don't think this is vulture capitalism. I think it's capitalistic vulturism. This is not what Bain Capital has done is not fundamentally different from a huge sector of our industry in this country, which is making money through essentially financial trickery. And I don't mean fraud, although we have seen a tremendous amount of fraud involved in the entire financial crisis. But this idea of financializing and turning companies into financial instruments, as opposed to entities that provide services, that hire workers, but making money off the spread, making money by loading them up with debt, making money by stripping them of assets, making money by changing what the holding company is filing for in taxes. These are all financial games. And this has been going on for 30 years in terms of these leverage buyouts, which is what we used to call these private equity firms. This is nothing new. And we also see it in the context of corporations where a board of directors and CEOs, they go in and they will do a similar thing to their own companies with a disregard of the long-term stability of the corporation or the company, but they'll go in and make short-term decisions that will ultimately just simply help their stock options. They're literally running these companies as a function of their cottage industries, and their cottage industries have turned these companies into financial instruments. And so it is fascinating. It is fascinating. Let's take a call here. Aaron from KPHX, listening on the web. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. How you doing?
Oh, not bad. Well, here's the thing. I had an idea the other day when I was listening to Rachel Maddow talking about Rick Perry barely being able to get into this next debate. They said that essentially if any candidate had 7% in average of three national polls, they would then be able to qualify for the debates. Well, I was thinking, since Stephen Colbert has decided as of last night that he's going to throw his hat into the ring, what would happen essentially if we could actually get Stephen Colbert onto a Republican presidential debate and then him run far right of every candidate up there? Because, I mean, the guy's really the best at mixing in some of these right-wing talking points and stuff nowadays and just really making a joke out of it. I mean, if you look at his interview with Bernie Sanders, he actually came up with the best argument for Citizens United I have ever heard, and I don't have a reply to it personally. The idea being that since Viacom can put money into his show, that then they are buying political speech. So if Viacom can do it based on their business model, why then can't Monsanto?
That's actually, you know, on Mondays I'll go on to the Dylan Radigan program with a libertarian, Tim Carney, and he actually makes that same argument. And I don't necessarily have a perfect answer for it because, you know, you've got GE and Comcast who own MSNBC. There's a lot of political speech going on there. But, yeah, I'll tell you what would happen if Colbert was in the Republican debates. He'd probably win the primary. They seem to hate their candidate so much, and he's the only one who can get up there and actually be completely shameless. He has no record. He'd probably do quite well. I appreciate the call, Aaron. Let's go to clip number four. This is Rick Perry talking about how he can criticize Bain Capital's capitalism, but he's got his own that's okay.
Listen, I love capitalism. I mean, free market capitalism in the state of Texas has created over 1 million jobs. But this corrupt and fraudulent activity that's been going on in Washington, D.C., between them and Wall Street has to stop.
So there it is. Texas capitalism is okay. That's the one, I guess, ostensibly where you you basically go in, take the resources, hurt labor, and then walk away with the profits, which doesn't seem terribly different from what Bain Capital did. But you've got these Republicans who are criticizing this unique type of capitalism that Mitt Romney practices, yet the next step is for these Republicans to step up and say, how would they curb the excesses that they accuse Bain from partaking in? That is the best question for these people to ask. And we're going to talk to Robert Reich in just a moment about that very question.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Coming up next, Robert Reich.
And the postman told me,
we are back. Sam Cedar on loan from the Majority Report, filling in for Tom Hartman. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He's a former U.S. Secretary of Labor and author. His latest book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, is now in paperback. And, of course, you can check out his writing on a daily basis at robertreich.org. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And I really enjoyed your piece entitled Bane of Capitalism in response to Newt Gingrich's and Rick Perry's attacks on Mitt Romney for his time at Bain Capital.
Well, you know, interestingly, Sam, I mean, I've been making the same attacks. Many of us progressives, liberals, people left of center have been making the same attacks on Mitt Romney. But it's refreshing. Let's use the word refreshing. To hear Gingrich and Perry and other Republicans wake up to the reality that leveraged buyouts and what they call, I think Perry just called it, vulture capitalism, may not be particularly good for the public.
You know, you may have a future in Republican presidential politics.
Yes, I didn't know that I had a future. I would have never predicted it, but obviously I do.
All right, so let's dig into this a little bit because, you know, Perry's calling it vulture capitalism. And I think that you would probably agree with my perspective that this isn't a particularly unique aspect of capitalism. This form of capitalism has come to, if not dominate our capitalist system in this country, it has become exponentially a larger part of our economy. This whole financialization of our economy, this is just one part of it.
Yes, and it began in the 1980s. I mean, it was interesting that Newt Gingrich was saying that this is not traditional capitalism, what Bain Capital and Romney have been doing all these many years. But it is now traditional capitalism, borrowing a lot of money, taking over companies, putting them into some degree of danger because there's so much leverage, they're so borrowed up to the hilt, laying workers off, restructuring the company, slimming it down, and then selling it again, going public again, and pocketing very often handsome amounts of money and certainly good fees. That's what Bain Capital did. And is doing and continues to do. That's what private equity managers and funds do. That's kind of the essence of what a lot of conservative economists have been saying is exactly what capitalism needs. That's how we weed out underperforming companies. Of course, it does lead to a lot of pain for a lot of workers and a lot of communities. But until Newt Gingrich and Perry and other Republicans have started to complain about it, we never heard Republicans acknowledge all that pain.
And you know, I want to just zero in on one aspect of that. When we say underperforming companies, we're not talking about companies that are necessarily destined to go out of business. We're talking about companies that maybe they provide too much pension benefits, and by too much, I mean too much for a middleman like a leveraged buyout firm to come in and skim out of that. I mean, in other words, these aren't companies that are destined to fail. These are companies that can be exploited if you take it out of the workers.
Exactly. That's precisely the point. Underperforming in the lingo of Wall Street and financial markets and Bain Capital means there is more to be squeezed out in terms of profits and share prices. But squeezing out more doesn't mean that the companies were destined for bankruptcy, hardly. Squeezing out more simply means that the companies were being too generous to workers in terms of pay or pensions. The companies were being a little bit too sensitive to their communities in terms of being good corporate citizens.
Too sensitive to the quality of their products.
In terms of the profits and share prices and investors.
And so, give me your sense of the social utility of these things. I mean, I have this this sense that over the past 30 years, this leveraged buyout stuff is also just one element of the financialization of turning companies into financial products. Because we see
that's exactly right, Sam. I mean, one way of thinking about it is that a company that existed in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, companies thought of their stakeholders, not just shareholders, but stakeholders as being having important responsibilities and important voices in the company. And stakeholders were workers, they were communities, they were shareholders, to be sure, but shareholders were only one stakeholder. What's happened, though, over the past three decades is that that one stakeholder, the shareholder, has become the only stakeholder for Wall Street and for many companies. They no longer exist for their communities or for the nation or for their employees or for basically anybody else. So underperforming means you're underperforming for that one stakeholder, the shareholder. And leverage buyouts resulted from the perception that you could make money by buying companies that were being a little bit too sensitive to workers and communities and other interests if they could be squeezed to just generate higher share prices.
The thing I really enjoyed about your piece at robertreich.org was the piece Bane of Capitalism was that you took the next logical step, which sadly I think if we had a media that was sort of more interested in having this conversation about capitalism, we would hear more from them in general. But you basically challenged these critics of Bain Capital to take the next step. What would you do to essentially rein in these excesses that you're talking about? Well, they won't answer that question. They're already getting pushback from other Republicans. But what would you, Robert Reich, do?
Well, I think that we should restrict leverage buyouts. I think we should, in fact, as I said in the piece, there should be laws that say either leverage buyouts should be prohibited, or prohibited with regard to putting companies in jeopardy vis-a-vis a certain amount of debt. You don't want to flip companies. Maybe there should be a law that says you've got to hold company stock a certain amount of time. Or if you hold company stock a certain length of time, maybe 5 years or 8 years or 10 years, the capital gains tax that you pay is far less than you would have to pay. If you flip the company the way Bain Capital and other leveraged buyout mavens have done over the past 30 years, maybe if you're into the job of flipping companies, your capital gains ought to be much higher, 30, 50, 60% instead of the current 15 or 20%. You know, there are all kinds of implications in what Gingrich and Perry and other Republicans are doing by way of criticizing right now Romney, but what they ought to be done. The point of my piece is the press and the media, voters ought to say, all right, Mitt Romney, you're saying is doing something wrong. Well, exactly what other Republican candidates, what laws would you pass, to prevent, this kind of Bain capitalism?
And, you know, I have a radical idea, too, that actually some of our Democrats, some of the leaders of the Democrat Party would also start to propose these things and recognize this dilemma. Because I'll tell you, that movie that Newt Gingrich, or at least it was made in support of him, is to the left of some of the mainstream Democrats we hear from.
Well, I think it may fortify the backbone of some of the mainstream Democrats. You know, when Perry says, and Perry is criticizing Romney for taking other people's money and using other people's money in ways that that cause job losses, well, that's what Wall Street does every day. Right. I mean, that's why we used to have a Glass-Steagall Act to prevent the Wall Street investment bankers from using other people's bank deposits to make bets on. And the logical consequence of what Perry and others are saying with regard to the wrongs that Romney has committed is to resurrect Glass-Steagall. I mean, you know, Democrats, but particularly this is an opportunity for Republicans, I doubt that they'll take it, to be specific about how to reform capitalism. This is something the Democrats, when they start criticizing Romney in the general election, the president on down, we ought to be very prepared to answer the question, how do we reform American capitalism, save capitalism from itself? There's still a lot of work to do. Bain Capital is still doing exactly what it did before. Leverage buyouts, the private equity managers, they're still on a rampage.
It's absolutely the case, and I think, you know, if we do not hear leaders of the Democratic Party making these arguments, we're certainly going to hear the people from Occupy Wall Street make these arguments. Robert Reich, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate the piece, and people can read more of your stuff, obviously, at robertreich.org.
Thanks, Sam.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we get back, we'll take your phone calls. I really think in the next hour we're going to be talking to some Occupy Wall Street people, but I really think regardless of the implications of these attacks by Republicans on Romney for the primary contest, the real value of these attacks is going to be felt by the American people, and they're not going to go away because Occupy Wall Street is carrying the torch on these things. We've got to take a break. We'll talk more about this when we return.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman today. When we get back, your phone calls. We are back. Sam Cedar on loan from the Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com, filling in for the great Tom Hartman. The numbers here, 866-987-8466 or 866-987-TOM. You can also reach us at 866-745-2667. These private equity firms that, like Bain Capital, basically go in there. Mitt Romney did this for years. And the funny thing is to watch Mitt Romney, who started out weeks ago, maybe months ago. Now, I'm not going to, you know, if you're not sitting down, if you're driving, you may want to pull over because this is going to be pretty shocking. Mitt Romney has a habit of changing his positions on things. And sometimes he says things that are diametrically opposed to what he said in the far distant past, the midterm distant past, and frankly, sometimes within a week. So it's not going to come necessarily as a huge shock to you if you weren't aware of that. Mitt Romney just, I don't know, 2 weeks ago in the debates was talking about how Bain Capital created 100,000 jobs. He's a job creator. He knows how to create jobs. Well, now that people have started to dig into this claim, and found that, well, Bain Capital didn't exactly create 100,000 jobs because they also got rid of maybe 100,000 jobs. And so Mitt Romney is learning his lesson. He's now come out the other day and said, well, Bain Capital has created tens of thousands of jobs. And his latest ad that came out today, I guess, was the ad claims only, according to Greg Sargent at the Washington Post, the ad claims Romney only created thousands of jobs. And I think, you know, we may be, if we stick around long enough, if Mitt Romney's around long enough, we pay enough attention to him, we may see that we're just weeks away from him saying, okay, let's be honest. We cost some jobs, but I just got really, really rich. Let's go to the phones, 866-987-8466. Rocky, calling from KPTK. Welcome to the program, Rocky. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman.
Hello, Sam.
How you doing,
Rocky? One thing I haven't heard mentioned at all is when one of these vulture capitalists take over a company and bankrupt it, how many smaller companies are they affecting that aren't getting paid for, you know, supplying them with whatever they supply?
That's a great job. I mean, a great job. That's a great point, Rocky, because, I mean, this is one of the reasons why the auto industry bailouts are so important. If GM goes under, what happens is that there's literally hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who work for smaller companies that provide parts for GM, that provide services for its workers, that would all also have gone under. And you're right. We don't hear what happens when a Bain Capital, when any of these leveraged buyout firms go in. And of course, you know what they do, Rocky, is that they have these entities load up on debt, because that debt then becomes part of this holding company, and then the holding company pays a different tax rate on the interest for this debt than they otherwise would. It's all part of this financialization. But you make a great point. Nobody's looking into the implications of not just the job losses that are of these companies that are shut down by a Bain Capital, but the ancillary and subsequent job losses by companies that work for them. I appreciate the call. It's a great point. Let's go to David calling from Seattle. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks, Sam. Love your show. Yeah, you know, all of
it's not mine. It's Tom Hartman's, but I appreciate it.
You know, all this big government collective bargaining and environmental regulation that the right wing complain about, in my view, these are inefficient back-end attempts to curtail the externalities of that 1886 president that J.C. Bancroft Davis fraudulently represented. He represented that case, addressed all the counterpoints that our forefathers set for the corporate charter. I would say, to keep it simple and to shrink government, bring back the corporate charter process.
And so what are you saying?
That Robert.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I would say to impeach Judge Roberts, he basically proactively expanded the scope of Citizens United to the 14th Amendment. He reversed all relevantly deliberated presidents, undoing Theodore Roosevelt's legitimacy, and somehow he stopped short of verifying the Southern Pacific Railroad deliberations that were never verified. The court reporter's head notes, J.C. Bancroft,
right,
fraudulently misrepresented that case. So we can simplify all of this with the debate with Mitt Romney being the face of corporate personhood. that this was an illegitimate precedent in the beginning.
Right. No, I agree with you. It is an illegitimate precedent. But, you know, you also got to look back to what Powell did on the Supreme Court back in the early 80s. Many of his cases sort of carried the football, if you will, in terms of developing the set of rights that we allow these entities. And these, you know, corporations do not exist in nature. They are, in fact, chartered by our government. They don't exist in nature. And so the idea that they have some type of inalienable rights is ludicrous. It's simply ludicrous. And when Lewis Powell, after he had authored that memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, ended up on the Supreme Court, he basically carried out this agenda of creating a whole, I guess, a set of rights for these corporations. And it's no coincidence that he was building this body of rights for corporations about 30 years ago. And the past 30 years, we have seen what it has done to wages in this country. We have seen what it has done to worker protections in this country. We have seen what it has done for income distribution and income inequality in this country. And we have seen the impact that income inequality has had on our government and its responsiveness to average to the 99%. We're going to take a break in the next hour, Occupy Wall Street. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman today on loan from the Majority Report at Majority.fm. And we've got a real big week coming up this week with Occupy movements across the country. All of this is happening with sort of in parallel track to what we see in the Republican primary race, where you've got Republicans criticizing the Mitt Romney as essentially being part of the 1% that is fueling the economic inequality in this country, that has sort of mutated capitalism into this thing over the past 30 years, that does not perceive any value economically to workers' rights, to any of us. And on the phone to talk about some of the actions that Occupy is going to be taking over the next week, and also on Monday and on Sunday, for that matter, to celebrate Martin Luther King Day, is Kaneen Holder from Occupy Wall Street. Kaneen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now, Kaneen, you are from Occupy Wall Street, is that right?
Yes, well, I'm from Brooklyn, New York, but yes, I've been working with Occupy Wall Street since about day 8 or day 9.
And Occupy Wall Street you got a lot of actions that are going to be taking place next week. I believe some of them are going to be starting in New York on Sunday. Tell us about those.
Oh, yes. It's going to be a beautiful worldwide event, actually, on January 15th, Martin Luther King's actual birthday. It's going to be a candlelight visual called Light the Dream, Share Your Story, which you can actually upload to occupydream.org once you light a candle and you share your story about what your dream is. And so 7 p.m., wherever you are in the world, they ask that you light a candle and take a stand and share your dream. And so specifically in New York City on that day, we're going to be marching from St. John the Divine, which is a beautiful church, historic church in Harlem, and we're going to have the candlelight visual in front of that church and then move and march about 15 blocks or so to the Riverside Church in Harlem, the historic church where Martin Luther King addressed the congregation, speaking specifically out against the Vietnam War. And that is when he really explored the full intersections of injustice and spoke not only about racial injustice, but also socio and economic injustice. and really also an anti-war message. And so that's why we've got no better place, actually, than the Riverside Church to have all of that happen.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I think Martin Luther King's, that part of his legacy is the least celebrated, at least in many circles, or in the sort of facile way that some people will celebrate his legacy. That legacy that he really turned, and particularly as marked by that that speech at the Riverside Church, really turned to the broader issues of social justice.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we're operating under the fierce urgency of now, as King liked to refer to it as. And so we have no time for this fairy tale version of Martin Luther King. Like we can't afford for his depiction to be so vapid and to be so empty of who he truly was and the spirit in which he truly occupied, in terms of how he was able to really articulate what this new world, this dream, would sound, look, and feel like. And especially myself as an educator, I've taught everywhere from kindergarten all the way up to college. And, you know, I've always, for the past 10 years, been teaching from a social justice perspective. And so I always, you know, allow my kids to fully explore each and every one of these historic figures, and especially Martin Luther King, because I see a lot of teachers, you know, oh, he had a dream. You know, they play the speech, and boom, that's it. They don't mention the fact that Martin Luther King also says that America wrote a bad check to black people and reneged on a promissory note. They don't mention these things. And I think that as young as like second grade, third grade, they need to know these things. This is a new generation of visionaries and leaders and activists and people who are passionate to live the best dream possible. And so why keep that from our youth? Why keep that from the most curious and the most fertile minds? And so I definitely agree with what you just said in terms of like really exploring who this man was.
You know,
and to some people, it will make them uncomfortable, and it'll make it seem like, because they're married to a myth, you know, and not to the reality of who he is.
I think that's exactly it. I think it is uncomfortable for people to look back and realize that in his time, he was a very controversial figure. He was called all the things, frankly, that the people involved in the Occupy movement are called. Radical, communist, a social dissenter, saying he didn't have the right to interrupt official meetings. That's not part of your free speech rights. Getting back to just some of what is planned over the next week, on Monday, Occupy the Dream, and I believe that the site is occupydream.org.
Also upload your video for the share your story when you the candlelight visual. Mm-hmm.
And there are actions also taking place on Monday in front of Federal Reserve buildings around the country. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. So there are actually several events that are Occupy-related happening on the 16th in New York City and then also throughout the country. So specifically on the 16th at 9 a.m., the Reclaim the Dream. Reclaim the Dream has been organized by myself and some other people within the People of Color Working Group and other people in Occupy Wall Street. We are actually going to celebrate and honor Martin Luther King at the African Burial Ground, which is actually steps past where the where Zuccotti Park is. And a lot of people don't know. Like, again, as a teacher, you know, I wasn't taught when I was a child that New York City had slaves.
Right.
They taught me that slavery only happened in the South. So when I became a teacher, I took up that opportunity to teach children that, you know, unfortunately, America has always been in the business of exploiting the many for the benefit of the few. And so that's why we decided to do it at the African Burial Ground, to really highlight Martin Luther King's dream, that this would never happen again, that these injustices, these social and economic injustices, would never happen again. But it's happening right now in our lifetime, with the amount of people who have hemorrhaged their homes, their pensions, their jobs. It's happening right now as we speak. And it is a crisis. And so that's why we're going to do a whole ceremony at the African Burial Ground. We're also going to include, because I'm theater, the dice of injustice, okay? Uh-huh. You know, take a chance or take a stand. You know, chances are, you know, you roll the dice, and the dice is going to have words on it, like foreclosed homes, endless war, inadequate school systems. You know, we're going to roll the dice, and let's see what comes up. Ha-ha, because we live in America.
All right, well, Kenny, we have less than a minute left, the rest of the week is going to be dominated by Occupy Congress. Is that right in D.C.?
Yes, indeed. So after the African Burial Ground, we're going to march to the Fed, and that's Dr. Benjamin Chavis and Norman Siegel and some other leaders, and that's all on the 16th. Then the 17th down in D.C. is Occupy Congress. There's also End Corporate Personhood, which is from the 20th all the way through to the 23rd of January. So, you know, this is just an ongoing conversation and examination of, again, the intersections of injustice in our society. Well, and if we are going to be an Americans and be the example and arbiter of what democracy is throughout the world, we have to take an examination and look at ourselves first.
Kenneen Holder from OccupyDream.org, Occupy Wall Street. Can't tell you how much I appreciate the work you're doing. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Your calls at 866-987-8466. Coming up next.
But people followed him into the street, marching and singing.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman today, on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm. I have been talking a lot about Occupy Wall Street, well, I guess for several months now, but I still think it's the most exciting thing that's happened in American politics in some respects in my entire lifetime, because it has broadened what we mean when we say politics. It has broadened the scope of it. It has gone beyond the normal and a banal notion of politics as simply being electoral. It is creating a political force that is changing the narrative in the country. I mean, we saw how quickly, once there was people in literally hundreds of Occupy encampments around the country, and for that matter, the world, how quickly the narrative changed from this idea of austerity and deficit cutting to focus back on jobs and to income inequality. And this past week and a half, I mean, we had a study that came out last week showing the real incredible lack of social and economic mobility in this country that put us far down the list of industrialized nations. And earlier this week, the Pew poll came out with a poll that showed what Americans think is the greatest conflict within American society. 34% of Americans think there are strong conflicts between young and old. This is a function of the Republicans trying to create this intergenerational theft meme to scare you into believing that Social Security is not operable, is not functioning, and will not be there for you in the future. When we know that if there's anything else that anybody else out there can tell me, which is a guaranteed payoff 25 years in the future, Social Security completely funded 100% benefits through the year 2036. And then after that, if we do nothing, if we do not raise the cap, which is a very easy fix, if we do not bring the amount of income by Americans up to the traditional 90% of all income generated from where it's now at 81%, if we do nothing whatsoever, we'll get 78% of promised benefits. If you can name one thing that you can tell me you can count on 25 years out, I'll eat my hat. I'll eat this study right here. 38% of Americans say there are strong conflicts between black and whites in this country. 62% of Americans say there are strong conflicts between immigrants and native-born citizens. But 66% of Americans believe there's serious class warfare in this country. 66% of Americans. Can you tell me where you can find 6 or 7 out of 10 people in any room to agree on anything? And these numbers cut across political lines. They cut across age lines. They cut across even income distribution. Well, 75,000 and up. They don't. I would imagine there's the 1% does not necessarily agree with this assessment, but they're only 1%, so they're not going to show up in the polls anyways. 73% of Democrats, 68% of independents, and, of course, only 55% of Republicans see strong conflicts between rich and poor. And all this is happening at that time that Newt Gingrich is coming out with this anti-Bain capital, frankly, anti-capitalism documentary. And I think is a perfectly legitimate critique of capitalism. And part of that has been the Occupy movement. I want to play this clip. It's actually a month old now, but I don't know if you've heard this. It almost made me cry when I heard this. I'm serious. These are students at Princeton University, one of the most elite universities in the country. In the country. And they are attending a J.P. Morgan recruitment talk. And in the middle of that talk, they get up and mic check J.P. Morgan. I want you to listen to this. Clip number 9. It is so impressive. If you're worried about the future, this should at least provide you some measure of hope.
Mic check!
Mic check!
Princeton's motto is...
Princeton's motto is...
In the nation's service and service of all nations...
In the nation's service and service of all nations...
J.P. Morgan, change your actions, violate our motto.
J.P. Morgan, change your actions, violate our motto.
Your predatory lending practices helped crash our economy.
Your predatory lending practices helped crash our economy.
We bailed out your executives' bonuses.
You evicted struggling homeowners.
While taking their tax money. You support mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia. Which destroys our ecological future. In light of these actions, we protest the campus culture. That whitewashes the crooked dealings of Wall Street. As a prestigious career path. We are here today. As a voice for the 99%. Shut out by a system that punishes them.
It is stunning. It's a stunning video, and we'll try and get that up on TomHartmann.com. To see college students who know that they are amongst the privileged few who go to a private university, some of them may get some financial aid, but I mean, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars a year, speaking up and also trying to impact their other students, so that they perceive that there may be some other things to pursue. There are other means in which they can determine whether or not they are a success in life, other than just the accumulation of more and more money. I literally almost cried when I watched that video for the first time. Terribly impressive. We'll come back. We'll take more of your calls when we get back. 866-987-8466.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar, sitting in for the great Tom Hartmann. Your call's coming up next. We are back. Sam Cedar on loan from the Daily Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com, sitting in for the great Tom Hartmann. Always a pleasure and an honor to do so. Great rendition of All You Fascists by Billy Bragg. I had not heard that one. I love it. We are talking about a couple of things today, but not the least of which is the stunning turn of events where we see the Republicans, or at least Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry, turning on Mitt Romney and not criticizing him for anything that he is done in his personal life or anything that he has done that is so-called unethical or illicit, but turning on him for his role as a member of a company, of an outfit, of a firm that was a leveraged buyout firm. His role in the financialization of our economy. Essentially, they are indicting Mitt Romney, not for doing something illicit, but for participating in what is going, becoming an ever-increasing part of our, of capitalism as we know it in this country. It is a critique of capitalism. It is a moral critique of capitalism that we never hear from the Republican Party, that we sadly do not hear enough from members of the Democratic Party, that we are only hearing consistently from Occupy Wall Street and others in the activist community and other commentators and whatnot. But they are the ones who are keeping this in the narrative. And it's fascinating to watch when someone who is so part of the elite establishment in this country, to just get a sense of just how divorced from reality they are. I think Tom yesterday on the program was talking about Collapse by Jared Diamond, one of the most fascinating books I've read in years, which talks about how societies historically have collapsed when the ruling elite or the establishment, the aristocracy, however you want to define it, is so cut off. They're living essentially in not only literally gated communities, but a metaphorical gated community. They are so far removed emotionally, intellectually, from the experience of the average person that they fundamentally destabilize the country, and the country drives off a cliff. And to just give you a sense of this, here is Mitt Romney. Now, you got to assume the guy knows he's on TV because he's being interviewed by Matt Lauer on the Today Show. It's not like this is candid camera. And I want you to listen. Now, the critique of his critique of President Obama trying to stoke a class war, this is old hat. But listen carefully for where and when Mitt Romney thinks it's appropriate to talk about income inequality. This is just stunning. Clip number 9.
Are there no fair questions about the distribution of wealth without it being seen as envy, though?
I think it's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms and discussions about tax policy and the like. But the president has made this part of his campaign rally. Everywhere we go or he goes, we hear him talking about millionaires and billionaires and executives and Wall Street. And it's a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, and I think it'll fail.
It's only appropriate to talk about income inequality, according to Mitt Romney, in quiet rooms. I'll tell you, the only time for someone of the establishment and the elite, a multimillionaire, to express that sentiment should be in a quiet room. To go out in front of the American public and say, implicitly, income inequality, yes, it's true. There is massive income inequality, virtually unprecedented income inequality, at least within the last 80 years or so, 70 years. But you really don't talk about that in public. That's rude. I mean, I wish there was a follow-up. Like, why only in quiet rooms? Is it rude? This is what I tell my 6-year-old daughter. Yeah, don't talk about your bodily functions in front of other people. It's rude. It's inappropriate. Now, I think the answer is that you just don't let the people know. You just don't want the peasants to understand just how much they're getting screwed. That's why you do it only in quiet rooms. I would imagine that Romney would say, oh, well, I would only do it in groups of like 10 or 15 people. You know, people who have lost their jobs or this and that. Then I'd sit them down and explain to them why there's income inequality. But it's just not appropriate to make it public. And the real question is, just how public? Now, we know Occupy Wall Street. Next week, we talked about what they're going to be doing. The real question is what is the president of the United States, the most prominent Democrat, when he is handed this gift? Now, regardless of what you, I am quite skeptical about, the gulf between President Obama's rhetoric and his actions. But leave that aside for a moment. Will the president seize this opening? Will the president use this gift he has been given by Newt Gingrich, by Rick Perry, by President Romney to really discuss these issues? Here's a hint. I don't know for sure, but there was a speech just given by Alan Krueger, who is the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, talking about income inequality. We can't go back to the type of policies that exacerbated the rise of inequality and threatened economic mobility in the first place if we want an economy that builds the middle class. We have incredibly diminished economic mobility in this country. We have increasing and nearly unprecedented economic inequality. He goes on to say, this means that we must adequately regulate excess risk-taking and corrupt practices in financial markets. Just what Robert Reich was talking about in the first hour of this program today. Krueger goes on to say, we're growing together for the first three decades after World War II. This is what Paul Krugman calls the Great Compression, when income disparity actually shrunk. And Tom has written a wonderful book entitled Screwed about the status of the middle class and the growing of the middle class in the 1950s and 60s. And he makes the argument that, in fact, it was because of the financial security that people were feeling in those days that they were willing to take the next step and fight for political and social emancipation. And that's, of course, when we get the blowback from the establishment, the Powell memo, and everything that was subsequently took place there. Krueger went on to say, in the first decade of the 2000s, the income of median household had grown at the same rate as it did in the 1990s. Middle-class households would have had an extra $8,900 a year to spend on their mortgages, rent, cars, food, and clothing, or to add to their savings. But frankly, the sort of tech bubble that we went through in the 90s was a bit of a blip in an otherwise fairly consistent 30 years of wage stagnation, of growing income disparity. And now, first off, I guess I should have apologized to all of you. I don't mean to say this in public. I know that we're only supposed to say this in quiet, hushed rooms. But let's take a quick call. Woody calling from KPHX. Welcome to the program, Woody.
Well, thank you. What got me calling today was Robert Reich's comments. And I'm 34 years USDA. We're being cut because we carry out the wishes of Congress, but one of those that concerns me the most, and I heard CBS this morning have a program on Solyndra and how terrible it was and how it's going to cost taxpayers, et cetera. It's been both parties that have come up with this idea of a guaranteed loan program, and we have many guaranteed loan programs throughout government, housing, farmers, other enterprises like Solyndra. And the point of the story is that, well, the investors are pretty much held whole because we guaranteed their profit or their, base, the investment. But the workers and the society gets to pay for that. And right. I think that's been a big component of balancing or putting that inequality in place by our government.
Yes, I mean, I think you got a good point here. What we set up, and I appreciate the phone call, what we set up is a system of socializing the risk and privatizing the rewards. And the only argument I have with the validity of that is one that must be adjudicated on a case-by-case basis. I think there is a real interest on behalf of the American public, on behalf of our entire society, to develop technologies that are going to get us independent of carbon-based fuels. I think there is a legitimate social interest in that instance. I think that we need to use these things, the guaranteed loans, in a very limited but specific way. It must be a very high threshold that there's going to be a benefit for the entire society and for future generations. So I think we see government always picking winners and losers. It's just that we have to be smarter about the winners that we pick.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sam Seder in for Tom Hartman. More of your calls coming up next.
Thank God it's
Friday. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's Friday. And it's Sam Seder in for the great Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from the Majority Report. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to talk. I haven't spoken to her in quite a while. Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News, live from the White House. Welcome, welcome, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
And so tell us, what's happening?
Well, the president said today in the East Room to a group of business leaders, the government we have is not the government we need. It's redundant and inefficient. And with that, he will call on Congress to give him a type of reorganizational power last held by a president when Ronald Reagan was in office. It will be called consolidation authority, and it will allow him to propose mergers that promise to save money and help consumers. What it is he wants to consolidate a whole bunch of departments into one department, specifically the Commerce Department, to be merged with the Small Business Administration, Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, Export-Import Bank, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and the Trade and Development Agency, all consolidated into one department with one phone number and one website to make things easier for small businesses.
Wow, this is really this is the one that Rick Perry couldn't remember in the Republican
exactly.
debate.
You know, exactly.
And people should also know that the Commerce Department, if I remember correctly, its budget, relatively speaking, is not terribly big. I think it's around $6-7 billion a year, but it serves at least multiple constitutionally mandated procedures, right? The census and trademarks.
Yes, it does. And those are going to go into particular places. And also NOAA is there. Now, NOAA is actually going to go, that's oceans, is going to go into the Department of the Interior. Now, the census, in quite a complicated way, is going to be taken care of. Now, this is going to eliminate between 1,000 and 2,000 jobs through attrition, and it will save $3 billion over 10 years. But the aim really is to make things better, leaner, and more efficient for small businesses so that they can get their work done. Obama said today, no business or nonprofit leader would allow this kind of duplication or unnecessary complexity in their operations. So why is it okay in our government? It's not. It has to change. Talking about five different entities involved in housing and more than a dozen agencies that regulate food safety.
This is, I got to tell you, Victoria, I mean, it sounds, it's as far as I can tell, it just sounds like some politicking. I mean,
he promised it in his State of the Union.
Oh, he's going to put this in the State of the Union?
He put it in the State of the Union last year
right.
that he was going to do it.
And so this is just basically trying to head off, what he anticipates is some critique, some line of critique by the Republicans. But, you know, it feeds into this narrative that he has somehow grown government. He has presided over the greatest shrinking of government in terms of personnel in 30 years. We've seen the loss of, at least this year, of 280,000 government jobs, a two-year freeze on federal workers. And in some ways, when he comes out and does this, I think it feeds into that narrative. But nevertheless, I'm sure that the Beltway establishment love to hear these type of things.
Well, the aim is not to feed into that narrative. The aim really is to feed into the narrative of making things better for small businesses so that they can grow jobs, and so that they can get their work done, and so that, America in Main Street can thrive.
Well, I hope it works that way. I guess now a small business doesn't have to go to two websites.
Well, actually, what was so extraordinary was he showed us a huge, he had a big board, and he showed us how many there were, like 20 or 30. It was ridiculous.
Maybe it'll help.
Well, we'll see, because he can't do this on his own. It has to be done through legislation, so he's calling for an up or down vote by Congress within 90 days, and of course there's the rub. How will Congress react? So far, mixed reaction from the Republicans. We'll see.
Interesting. So he's basically putting stuff on their docket to challenge them to do something.
That's part of it.
And so what else is happening over there?
Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, has notified the French government of its decision to downgrade the country's credit rating from AAA, long cherished, to one notch to AA+. And that is a big blow to France's international standing, and it knocks the country out of the top financial league of the Eurozone. Now, I've also heard that Austria is being downgraded as well, and we're hearing that these may not be the last two countries to be downgraded. The S&P put a number of Eurozone countries on a sort of watch in December, and there may be other countries who are going to be downgraded as well. Obviously, Wall Street is down today, about 1% across the board, different ones in different ones. This is very worrying. As you know, our unemployment was down last month. The economy is starting to look a little bit better. But this is the kind of thing that is worrying as one of the headwinds that we could face if indeed Europe falls into some kind of a deep recession or even a depression, if all these countries get downgraded and they face severe problems. There will be a knock-on effect here.
Yeah, the real problem is going to be is if they react to these downgrades by imposing more austerity actions, because we've seen austerity fail in Greece. We've seen it fail in Ireland. It's simply you cannot contract your way into expansion.
And this is what's so interesting, because this seems to be the reaction. They don't seem to want to look at other ways of dealing with their problems, except for Iceland, who chose to go a different route.
Absolutely. Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News, thanks for catching us up today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, there you have it, folks. And, one has to wonder why, when you have so much evidence about the implications of austerity, why it's still imposed. And, it's that age-old question about the establishment. Evil or stupid? I think there's probably a combination of both. We're going to take a break. Sam Seder in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Seder on loan from the Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com in for the great Tom Hartman. You may have heard the story that Stephen Colbert is contemplating a run for president. And, of course, this means that he had to hand over his super PAC to Jon Stewart, and then ostensibly has absolutely no connection with it anymore. They're not coordinating. They're separate entities. And on the phone, fortunately, well-timed, we have Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on, among other things, the Supreme Court, and in particular, things like corporations being people and what that means for super PACs. Welcome to the program, Dahlia.
Hi there, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. Now, I want to talk to you about the Supreme Court in general, but before we get there, I guess it was last week that the Montana Supreme Court, maybe it was the beginning of the week, the Montana Supreme Court, in defiance of the U.S. Supreme Court, basically upheld a statute that said corporations cannot participate in our politics.
That's exactly right. I think we should call it what it is. It's just nullification. They just said Citizens United doesn't apply to us. In the wake of Citizens United in 2010, similar campaign finance laws that were state campaign finance laws got, you know, struck down around the country. Either courts did it or they were repealed. It was clear none of these laws could stand anymore. There was a challenge to the Montana statute. This is a 100-year-old statute from 1912. It looks substantially similar to the ban that was struck down in McCain-Feingold, except the Montana Supreme Court looks at the challenge and says, 5-2, you know what, we're going to let it stand here in Montana. We think it's still constitutional. And they say, yes, we understand that Citizens United is the law of the land, but our statute is different and our state is different, and here's why.
So now, in the Citizens United case, the big issue was that the court, and I think it was Kennedy who wrote this, found no evidence or indication that corporate money in any way is either corrosive of the political process or even appears corrosive of the political process. Is that accurate?
That's pretty much right, and it's worth just saying as a side note that he did that just a few months after handing down this big West Virginia decision, also 5-4, also that Kennedy wrote, saying that big money completely corrupts election campaigns, in that case the Virginia Supreme Court campaign. So he manages to distinguish what happened in the West Virginia election from what happens under McCain-Feingold.
That's a very polite way of saying he completely did a 180 on this over the course of a couple of months. Wasn't there also in the issue of Citizens United that he also argued that what will prevent the corrosive effects of corporate money on politics or the appearance of it being corruptive is the fact that there'll be plenty of disinfectant in the form of sunlight and public awareness? And he was wrong.
That's exactly right. I mean, what he said is he really hinged his decision on the idea that there is transparency here. First of all, these are completely independent expenditures, right? This is not coordinating with the campaign. Anyone who's watched what has happened with the super PACs in the last couple of weeks in the primary season knows that the idea that they're not coordinating, right? There's a super PAC that's being run by John Huntsman's father, but they're not coordinating with the Huntsman campaign. You know, the Romney super PAC, which is staffed by former Romney staffers, is not coordinating. So that one piece of it was that there would be true independence, there wouldn't be coordination, haha. And the other is, as you say, that there will be transparency, that people can donate, but we're going to know who's donating. We're going to know who's buying and selling our candidates, except that because of the super PACs, also has not materialized. So we have neither transparency nor do we have this independence. So both kind of the promises of Citizens United have not materialized, or better, they've been completely annihilated by super PACs.
And as far as the transparency, the way that these organizations get around it is how they have just created entities that essentially don't require disclosure until when?
Well, they were supposed to be disclosing now, but they rejiggered so that their filing deadlines were changed. And so instead of filing, somehow they changed the quarterly filing into something else so that we're not going to know, we're not going to get the disclosure we were supposed to get this month until next month. So that seems like it's not a big deal, but it's a huge big deal in terms of, the primary season as we have it now. So literally they just, applied to have the deadlines rejiggered, and they were rejiggered. And so now we truly do not know. The thing that was supposed to be disclosed will not be disclosed for some time.
So let me just get this straight. So when Kennedy talks about transparency, this is just part of his rationale in terms terms of his decision. But there is no law that explicitly says this needs to be revealed before the election takes place. It's just that this needs to be revealed as to who contributed. And because you have some sort of more bureaucratic ability to change the filing dates, we're going to find out, or I should say, let's say, for instance, in South Carolina, people in South Carolina are going to find out who donated to Huntsman's Super PAC after they voted.
That's right. And it's really important to think of these super PACs as sort of hydras that kind of arise after Citizens United. I mean, Citizens United tries to stop up the ick in certain ways, and super PACs essentially rise up from that and say, okay, well, then we're going to work around this by doing this. We're going to work around this by doing that. So these are creatures that are a creation of both Citizens United and a subsequent lower court ruling. But it's really important to recognize that, you know, had Citizens United provided that other things needed to be required, we would have PACs that work around those things. That's the nature of campaign finance reform. You try to stop the money from pouring in. The money always finds some different route, Sam. This is the route the money has found.
I'm talking to Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, who is one of the most knowledgeable reporters on what the Supreme Court does, and anyone that I know. And we're talking about Citizens United in light of the Montana Supreme Court basically saying, we're not going to follow Citizens United. You may have found, essentially, that corporate money does not corrupt politics, but in Montana, we have a long history of it, and we found that it does. That's basically their argument, isn't it?
It's an amazing opinion. I can't emphasize enough how much it's worth reading, not just for the majority opinion written by the Chief Justice Mike McGrath on the Montana Supreme Court, who does the two things you just flagged, Sam. One says, you don't know anything about Montana, and let us tell you a little bit about the last Gilded Age and the so-called Copper Kings and how they, you know, wrought havoc across the state. They bought judges, they bought the senators, they owned the media. The whole state was just completely disastrously ruined by a handful of out-of-state wealthy robber barons who just gutted anything that was a fair election. That's what we were responding to with their 1912 statute, says Justice McGrath, and that is the thing that doesn't really materialize in your analysis in Citizens United. The other thing he says that's really interesting is he just lays out what is happening with one sort of private group that has tried to buy elections in Montana and how they've promised anonymity and a lack of transparency to people who want to donate. So he basically is not only saying this is our history, which he reviews rather extensively, as I said. But then he says, I'm just going to call out this one group who has been unbelievably shameless in trying to buy Montana elections. And the final piece of it, Sam, that's so interesting is that Montana Supreme Court justices are elected. They're not appointed. So
he knows firsthand just how corrupt of corporate money is. All right, well, Dahlia, will you hang with me? Because I've got so many questions for you, some particularly in terms of foreign nationals being able to participate in our elections. And I want to know what the implications are of corporations that own media outlets on political speech. We'll be right back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar, filling in for Tom Hartman. When we come back, more on the importance of the Supreme Court. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to have on the program. And thank you for holding, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. And Dahlia, in the last segment, we were talking about how the Montana State Supreme Court essentially is engaging in nullification in some way by telling the U.S. Supreme Court, we're just not going to accept the Citizens United ruling. And before we move on to sort of tangential issues surrounding Citizens United in Montana, what happens next? I mean, what is the law of the land in Montana now? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dahlia. What is the law of the land in Montana now?
the law of the land, at least in Montana, is that their campaign finance ban survives scrutiny. It still stands. I don't know that I've ever read a state Supreme Court opinion that looks more like an engraved invitation to the U.S. Supreme Court to be overruled. In other words, I think that all the smart money in this case now is on the Supreme Court smacking them down hard. Some say it's going to happen just summarily. In other words, this doesn't even have to go through the whole normal process. They're just going to get spanked. But I do think it's really important to, again, read the opinion. It's a fantastically savvy opinion about the real effect of money on politics and the real corrupting effect of huge corporate money on campaigns. But I also think it's just very attuned to the Occupy language we're hearing right now, to the zeitgeist in this country that thinks that Citizens United, excuse me, was just delusional in its assumptions that we could keep a pristine system going forward.
Now on Monday of this week, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed a lower court decision which basically upheld a congressional ban on foreign nationals spending money to influence the outcome of American elections. How is this reconciled? I mean, in other words, if the idea is, Dahlia, that foreign nationals could unduly influence our politicians by contributing money to campaigns, why wouldn't corporations have undue influence?
Well, I think this was, first of all, this was a four-word order out of the Supreme Court upholding a D.C. Circuit Appeals Court a decision. And I think that this was a question that was left open after Citizens United in his dissent. Then Justice John Paul Stevens sort of raised the question, does this call into question the statute that bans foreigners from donating? The appeals court said, look, they just don't have the same First Amendment rights. These are foreigners as Americans. And apparently that was persuasive to the court. So
as American corporations.
Well, I'm not going to attempt to square it with the thinking in Citizens United. That's beyond me. But certainly the argument is, it's a separate argument from the analysis that says somehow corporations have, feelings and hair, to say that whatever they have, Canadians in this case don't have those First Amendment rights. And so this was really, I think, the court answering, you remember President Obama after Citizens United at the State of the Union got right up in the court's face and said, what about foreigners pouring money into our elections? In a sense, this was the court just spiking it back and saying, we've now closed even the possibility of having that conversation.
But now, but don't you, aren't you afforded, if you are in this country legally, but are foreign national, aren't you afforded First Amendment rights?
If you're a permanent resident, you are. These were both people, both of the plaintiffs in the suit were here on very temporary visas. Okay. I think one was expiring next year and one the year after. So the argument is these are not foreigners who are here for the long haul. These are, I think both of them were lawyers, in fact, who were just here for a short amount of time. And the argument says they don't have the same First Amendment rights as Americans. Again, I wish we knew more. The court really just disposed of this with a quick order. So I think that there are good questions going forward. The court didn't want to engage in those this time.
We're talking to Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, and we were talking about the super PACs and how Justice Kennedy presumed that they would be at arm's length from the candidates. There would be no collusion and whatnot. And that that part of his decision has also, I think, been sort of like hilariously debunked by Stephen Colbert, who last night announced that he is starting a presidential exploratory committee and so therefore must hand over the reins of his super PAC to Jon Stewart, because otherwise it would be inappropriate according to campaign election law. But Stephen Colbert also brings up another argument that a caller reminded me that he brought up with Bernie Sanders, and I've heard this argument made before. If we are to overturn something like Citizens United and say that corporations do not have the right to free speech, at least in terms of, because they're not human, at least in terms of engaging in political campaigns, what do we do about entities like, for instance, Viacom or MSNBC, for that matter, which is owned by General Electric and Comcast? What do we do in those situations?
It's a great, great question, Sam. And I think that one of the things that's been obscured in the fallout from Citizens United is how hard the First Amendment questions were. We look at it now as a kind of Bush v. Gore of 2010. It isn't, and it's really important to understand that dyed-in-the-wool liberals like Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School, like Kathleen Sullivan from my alma mater, Stanford Law School, were passionately on the side of the corporations in this case, who really believed, because of exactly what you're describing, that there was an interest, a real media interest in protecting the speech interests here. And this case really, you know, it exploded on the American public, not because of the speech issues, which, as you point out, are really hard. It exploded because of the both the political valence of, you know, we have the five conservatives on the court seemingly putting a thumb on the scale for big corporations. But it also exploded because of the impact it was going to have, which we're seeing play out. But the kinds of questions that are raised about what about the New York Times? What about corporate free speech? Those are the reasons liberals supported, a lot of liberals supported the corporate side in this case.
Fascinating. Well, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.com, thanks so much for talking to us about this.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to take a break, folks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar sitting in for Tom Hartman today. When we come back, we will take all of your calls. That's right, it's Friday. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman on loan from the Majority Report at Majority.fm. We are just about 4 days away from what Occupy Wall Street calls J17. They will be engaged in the Occupy Congress all next week, including Occupy the Dream on Sunday and Monday, to celebrate Martin Luther King. And to reiterate that a big part of his message was about social justice. But coincidentally, January 17th is not only the four-month anniversary of the Occupy movement, it is also the date that signatures are due in Wisconsin to recall Governor Scott Walker. And it's a pretty stunning coincidence. Because in many respects, the outpouring of public protest back in Wisconsin and in Madison back in March of last year was a precursor. I mean, all of these things build on each other. I think when citizens see other citizens getting out there and standing up for their rights and for standing up for social justice, I think it encourages others. And so it's sort of a coincidence now that, at least from an electoral standpoint, that the date in which signatures are due in Wisconsin is January 17th. There needed to be about 500,000 Wisconsinites, 500,000 Wisconsinites, who signed a recall petition. Petition organizers are expected to submit an estimated 1.5 million signatures on January 17th. I gotta say, that's probably going to ruin Scott Walker's week. When you have 1.5 million people who want to see you recalled, I think you may have a little bit of a problem. Not as big of a problem as those people who have been working for 20, 25 years as a sanitation worker or as a some other public employee, and they're going to have their pensions cut. But you got a problem. So, Scott Walker, you should make sure that you got the Koch brothers on your speed dial because there's a very good chance that you're going to be asking them for a job very shortly. Let's go to Bobby, line two, calling from Scottsdale, Arizona, 1480. Welcome to the program, Bobby.
Hi, thank you. I just wondered, in the personhood decision with Citizens United, is it a female person or a male person? Is it a 7-year-old or a 25-year-old? How do they define person?
Well,
I don't know if it's,
Citizens United is not what defined corporations as people. Citizens United simply said that, more or less said that it's an established, it's established already that corporations have these rights of the First Amendment, and therefore it's an infringement on their First Amendment rights to not allow them to participate in political speech, and there's no overriding societal interest in keeping them out. But I like to think of corporations as being, like a 14-year-old junior high kid. That's basically the way I look at corporations.
How about a 14-year-old bully?
Yeah, I think that's probably more likely. It's a good point, Bobby. I mean, you know, what we really need to strike at when you look at these different competing movements, and they're not really competing. I think, and to a large extent, they're all working on a similar track. But to hold a constitutional convention, to get an amendment to the Constitution, that's why I think defining or passing an amendment that says corporations are not people is probably the most important.
Oh, yeah, well, it'll be reversed. If we can get rid of Scott Walker, we can get rid of this. It's
a little higher mountain to climb, Bobby, because you need to have a constitutional convention which will require two-thirds of state legislators, but I don't think it's impossible.
Wait, the Occupy movement has to keep at it. And actually, I'm working on a play about all of this, a one act, which I hope to put on YouTube. I'll probably get arrested, but, you know, they'll throw me in one of those military prisons. But it's, you know, my concept is, if not now, when, we have to take action and we have to reverse a lot of these horrible things, because little by little they're kind of chipping away at our freedom. And to think that money is speech or that corporations are in some way people, it's just absurd. And God bless Montana. I hope other states. I don't think Arizona ever will. They're so reactionary here, it's pathetic.
Well, I mean, hopefully, Bobby, we'll see other states follow suit, and it'll create a lot of pressure. But I appreciate the phone call. Let's go back to line 3. Lisa calling from KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on with Sam Cedar, filling in for the great Tom Hartman.
Hello, Sam. I just wanted to thank you for bringing up the Powell Memorandum. I don't think we're hearing enough about that, because I think it was the beginning of what has been happening for the last 30 years.
Indeed.
I think they took it very seriously. If you read it, hindsight is, of course, 20/20. You can see exactly step by step what he laid out for long-range planning for the taking over of corporate.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had, for people who don't know, we had the Powell Memorandum, the 30-year anniversary, I think, was just about a month ago. And this was a memorandum that was commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Lewis Powell at that time was an attorney. And he basically outlined how corporations and corporate America could basically strike back at what they saw the threats of the social emancipation movement and the power of labor unions at that time. And he provided a game plan, and which was basically, you guys need to get together, start organizations like the Heritage Foundation, start organizations like the Cato Institution, all these foundations. Shortly thereafter, you saw these foundations pop up. And then, you know what also helped was not just that he wrote this memorandum, but that he was appointed to the Supreme Court and had the ability, when these issues arose at the Supreme Court level, to be the swing vote in 5-4 decisions at that time. I think there's a book, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the author is Jeff Clement. I spoke to him some time back, and he wrote a book called Corporations Are Not People. And I think he dedicates an entire chapter to the Powell memo and how we still feel its implications today. I appreciate the call, Lisa. You're absolutely right. I don't think we're aware enough of the Powell memo and just how much of what we're seeing now was literally sketched out. It was sketched out as a game plan. Let's go to Armin, calling from Bradenton, Florida. Welcome to the program, Armin.
Hey, Sam. How's my man?
Well, your man is doing pretty well, if you're referring to me.
Well, yes, sir. Sam the man.
There you go.
Hey, if I may, please, I'd like to keep it real simple first about Romney.
Uh-huh.
What he's really, truly all about, if you follow his money and his whole career economically, the guy's nothing but a monopoly capitalist.
In what sense? In terms of, like, he promotes monopolism, or are you talking about in terms of the game?
Well, let me explain it to you like this. The group that he encircles himself with that gave him power and equity and his wealth, okay, they talk about, the Republicans keep talking about, you know, the free market and stuff. They've so distorted the meaning of it, and they've subverted the true reality of it so much with their corporate power and buying and paying off politicians and judges and, you know, lawyers and courts and everything. Simply ask yourself this, Sam, you're a smart person. How can you have a true free market system when 20% of the competitors own and control 95% of the capital, tools, and equipment that are necessary in order to compete in that market?
Well, Armin, I'll tell you what. Let me say this. First of all, there is no such thing as a free market. It has never existed.
Not effectively.
No, but yeah, that's what I'm talking about, and I appreciate the call. But my point is that we can talk about a theoretical free market. There has never been a genuinely free market. There can never be a genuinely free market. David Graeber, in his book, 5,000 Years of Debt, talks about the myth that markets existed before government. Markets didn't exist before government or society. Markets didn't exist in nature. No, markets are a function of societies. And as soon as you have a society which organizes a market, there is no free market. It is impossible to organize a market that is enforced by society where it is free, where there are not advantages or disadvantages to some parties involved in that market exchange. It just simply doesn't exist. So the problem we have in this country is that we have organized our markets. They have become organized by our establishment to benefit or disadvantage, I should say, labor, and most of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Sam Cedar, in for the great Tom Hartman. The number is 866-745-2667. We are back. Sam Cedar, in for the great Tom Hartman, on loan from the Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com. Always a pleasure to fill in for Tom Hartman. His audience, you folks, are one of the smartest audiences out there. And so always a pleasure, and I appreciate the help that Jacob and Sean have given me out of Tom's operation, and of course Matt helping me here in New York on loan, also from the Majority Report. My plan was to start the show out with this story from the New York Times, and frankly, we've been talking so much about the upcoming week's activities of Occupy Wall Street, and the stunning video put out by Newt Gingrich, well, his PAC, his super PAC, which he is now incidentally denouncing for putting out the video. But it's a stunning indictment of capitalism in this country, and I cannot recommend it to you enough. You can Google it when Mitt Romney came to town. But this story from the New York Times, it's a little meta, but it gives you a prime example of how our media, sometime in the past 30 or 40 years has lost sight of what its primary objective is, and that is to inform the public as to reality. You've got the New York Times ombudsman with the headline, "Should the Times be a truth vigilante?" I'm looking for reader input on whether and when New York Times news reporters should challenge, in quotes, facts that are asserted by newsmakers they write about. In other words, up to now, the New York Times reporters, their definition of news is simply what a politician, an administration, a newsmaker might say, without providing any context for the reader. If Mitt Romney is sitting outside and he says to the reporter, "It's a beautifully sunny day, and we'll have more of these sunny days when I'm president," the ombudsman of the New York Times is questioning whether or not the reporter should add in that story that if it's the case that it's a downpour, it is raining cats and dogs, whether or not they should write that. It's stunning. Somewhere along the line, the New York Times got the idea that its job is simply to be stenographers. And in other words, he writes about a reader writing to him, "If a candidate repeatedly utters an outright falsehood, I leave aside ambiguous implications, shouldn't the Times coverage nail it right at the point where the article quotes it?" And so the ombudsman, Arthur Brisbane, says, "This message was typical of mail from some readers who, fed up with the distortions and evasions that are common in public life, took to the Times to set the record straight. They worry less about reporters imposing their judgment on what is false and what is true." I'm sorry. When Mitt Romney says that Bain Capital has, for instance, has created 100,000 jobs, this is not an unknowable or subjective fact. The reporter can then say, "It is true that Bain has created 100,000 jobs. However, based upon these parameters, just in terms of companies that have shut down when been bought by Bain, they also contributed to the loss of 100,000 jobs," or whatever the answer is. But isn't this the way that we should determine whether or not we trust a news source? Is whether they are accurate and consistent in the way that they calculate these things? What is the value of a news source that just tells us a candidate is promising or making assertions? There's no value in that to the American public. It's stunning. It really is stunning. Let's go to Justin, KTLK, calling on 866-987-8466. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman.
Hey, Sam. Great show. You're awesome. I just kind of wanted, you know, the rant you got on about the New York Times, that is truly stunning. You know, my comment wasn't on that, but it was about the recall in Wisconsin. And if you look at the sheer physical numbers of it, okay, there's about 5.6 million people that live in Wisconsin. And of that 5.6 million, there's probably about 1.5 million people that are, you know, under the age of 18 that can't vote. Then of that, there's maybe 50% that vote. So that's down to 2 million people. And of those 2 million people, 1.5 million want the governor out. And those are actual stunning numbers if you think about it in those terms. And I tell you, you know, to be honest, it's been horrible what's gone on in Wisconsin. However, it's probably the best thing for actual democracy that's happened in a long time, because it's finally opened Americans, our eyes to what these people are really trying to do to our country.
Yeah, you got a great point, Justin. I mean, you have an overwhelming number of people in Wisconsin who are looking to recall Scott Walker. My only lament about everything that has happened in Wisconsin, aside from the actual implications of Scott Walker's policies, is that I had wished that some of that strike, some of that mentality was actually channeled into a wildcat strike. But I think come spring, we're going to see people in this country act upon the awareness and the realization that their power comes from withholding labor. That if you are willing to show to the establishment in this country, to the 1%, that you're willing to put yourself on the line in some regard, in the way that the Occupy Wall Street people have been doing, and that it is up to our elected leaders to fix it, fix these problems with our government, I think we're going to start to see some action. And so, as Tom says, tag, you're it. It is going to take people coming out of their homes and speaking out and protesting before we see any real change in this country. Voting doesn't hurt, but we're going to need to see more. Thank you all. You've been all been very gracious as I've been filling in for Tom.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.